This podcast episode is NSFP, not suitable for progeny. Enjoy Rise of the Rule Lords.
Yo, it's your exhausted and exhilarated Rule Lord. I'm just coming down off the high of Beginner Box Day. This was being run by the mod team, of which I'm part of, for Pathfinder 2E subreddit. And as some of you probably saw on Twitter, I've been shilling it a lot because I was the primary organizer for it. And god damn, is it something to see it go from just a regular spitballing idea to saying, like, hey, we'll try it, maybe we'll get 20 people, to having 110 sessions and over 500 player slots with 60 GMs in total. Holy cow! Now, with event organizing, usually the person who's doing it gets a lot of the credit, and that was me. But, like, the thing about organizing is that I am just a puppet master. I'm just working on getting all of the pieces to fit together. The real people that make it come together is everyone that helped me put the event together. So, huge props to Rox, first off, who is the dev for RPG Chronicles. Came up with a beautiful system for signing up for slots, and turns out that there is an admin feature if you reach out to him about it, if you're running your own big event for Pathfinder Society. He worked with us closely, he made a bunch of custom things for us so that this event would run more smoothly, and overall made what I thought was going to be a huge pain in the butt into a much more simplified, streamlined system. I really do think that it's going to overtake Warhorn as a primary method for people to organize big Pathfinder Society events, because it's so easy for people to sign up for it, and it's so easy to report the findings. I mean, this one event is kind of an outlier case because so many people don't actually know about Society. We're running it as a Society event because Pathfinder Society gave us a bunch of support for it. They gave us a lot of vouchers. They gave everyone a free PDF of the beginner's box, all the GMs, I should say. And that was huge, but we had to run it as a Society event, which added a level of complexity that maybe I wouldn't do next year. But really, if you're going to run a simple Society scenario, the beginner's box is the one to do it for because it is so easy to report. There is honestly nothing to report except for telling players that they have 8 days of downtime, which they can then use for a Society legal character that they choose to redeem later. And Paizo's been a huge help because they did a lot of comms work for it, more than I think I've seen for an independently run event. They even scheduled the release of the Virtual Tabletop Foundry Deluxe Beginner's Box module to release in conjunction with Beginner's Box Day, which, like, when does that happen? When does a company make a major business decision off of a non-company run event like PaizoCon? It just doesn't happen. And that was because this event was so successful. So many GMs signed up. So many were willing to run both levels of the beginner box, which in total amounts to like 10 hours of GMing over a weekend. Like, that's a huge time commitment, and it's a huge commitment to talk to a bunch of new strangers about Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Like, it's just never happened before. And not only that, but there was a huge response of people signing up to try it. Like, over 300 people registered for the event. And yeah, we lost a couple because, you know, scheduling conflicts is the bane of any event, whether it's your home group or, you know, a convention. But like, most people showed up, and we even had some last minute signups to fill up almost every table that we had available. And I just can't wrap my head around it. It's like, I made a website, I chose a date, I did back-end work to make things happen, but the real people that made this event successful are the people who showed up. And if you are one of those players, or one of those GMs, or someone who even just talked about the day to someone else, you're the ones who made this so successful, and I just was around to basically watch it and try to make it as easy as possible for people to participate. So yeah, it's really cool to see it all coming together. But it does mean that I wasn't able to record my full episode that I was planning to do about, you know, conditions. Instead, I'm doing one that's much more off the cuff. I'm gonna be swearing. Put a little thing saying, don't let your kids listen to this one, because I'm just gonna talk more casually about my own GM style and the inspirations that turned me into the GM I am today. I mean, being an event organizer is in my blood. I used to do it in college a lot for my student group. I fell in love with doing it and ran a bunch of different events, from speakers events to debates. And then I got a job at a organization where I got to do that a lot more on a much more national level, and haven't been able to do it since I lost that job until this. So it got all of that blood pumping again. But a lot of that organizer instinct in me comes out in me wanting to be a GM. I am a forever GM by choice. You'll often hear people say, like, oh, I'm just the GM and I really wish that I could play sometime. And I'm not that kind of person. I love to GM and I'm a terrible player. When I'm a player, I just sit and wait for my turn, and maybe I'll join in every once in a while with an idea, but so I'm not a great player, but I do love to GM. And getting to where I am now took a lot of watching of other GMs. I don't watch a lot of actual plays, so unfortunately my list that I'm going to be going over is a lot of white heterosexual men. I haven't really watched any actual plays that were run by women or people of color besides Bria Iyengar, who somehow within the course of like 3 weeks GM'd Critical Role, Dimension 20, and the Adventure Zone, three of the biggest actual play podcasts, which, good for her. I watched all those. She was fantastic. But a lot of my inspiration comes from popular media GMs, and they all happen to be white guys. And so I apologize initially that there's going to be a lack of diversity with these. And honestly, I would love to watch more people of color and women run actual plays. They're just also not the kind of media that I like to consume. So part of the reason why I've watched these other ones is because they've got high entertainment value, high production value, high spread. They're all over the internet. So that's why I primarily watch them rather than others. So if you have ideas that come from much more diverse GMs, I'd love to hear them. I think that we got a lot of that advice in my other episode, which was interviews with Vanessa Hoskins, Aubrey Knotts, and Quinn Murphy, who make up a much more diverse lineup than just me. So I was very happy that I got to have them on the podcast and them dispense their wisdom. So now I'm dispensing mine for whatever it's worth. So this is definitely not a must listen for the Pathfinder 2 rule set. This is just stuff that I picked up on, stuff that I think could be helpful for other GMs, people who are thinking about becoming game masters. And maybe you find it helpful, maybe you don't. In that case, like, sorry, but it's just what I'm doing because I only have a little bit of time this weekend with how the beginner box day is going. So I just wanted to do something quick so that we can, you know, do something for the podcast. And I'll talk about it more later, but this episode will be sponsored by Manscaped, who, apropos of nothing, offered me a trial run as a sponsorship opportunity. So I'll talk about that a little bit more later. But I do want to get it out that there will be a paid advertisement later in this episode. So My first GM inspiration was my first GM, Liz Liddell, who, if that name sounds familiar, yes, it is the same Liz Liddell who helped work on making Pathfinder 2nd Edition and is now working with Wizards of the Coast as the Magic the Gathering head editor. And I'm very lucky to have that connection. It was way before she, got the official role with Paizo. She actually used to be my boss, who invited me to play Pathfinder 1st Edition at her place. And I'm just going to say she is the most incredible person that you'll ever meet if you ever get a chance to meet her, to talk with her, interact with her. I definitely think of her as a friend first and a boss, former boss, very, 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 very distant. She's just awesome. And she was my first GM. She was a fantastic game master, and now I'm her game master as we run Quest of the Frozen Flame. But she started me off by running a campaign, Hell's Rebels, with me and some other friends from work and my roommate and another guy who I'd never met before, but now after all this time I'm good friends with. And the thing that really stuck out about Liz was that she was a constant resource in every conceivable way. She was always very accessible about rules questions. She provided a lot of material goods. And both of those things are things that I've tried to emulate myself. I think any good game master will be readily available to their players to ask questions, get guidance, spitball feedback about like character options and how do I do this, and I had a question about this during play. So that part should almost be a given, I would think. So the other thing that I've tried to emulate from her is being a material resource for my players. Now, this plan to be that started in the midst of COVID when we stopped having in-person games and largely went virtual. So right now I have a bunch of stuff, but I'm hopeful that when in-person games resume more regularly, that I'll be able to put all of this stuff into use. Stuff like I have a big bowl of dice, and that's something that Liz always had, was she had a big bowl of dice in case new people came along, they'd never had a dice set, just a bowl of conglomerated dice that people could choose from and roll from. They never even needed to buy their own if they kept playing with her. She just always had a shitload of dice for you to be able to use. And I really loved that about her because it was how I started, is using some of her old dice in a bowl and picking out my favorite colors and being like, oh, I really like this one, and finding it every time. So I've started to collect dice in the same way so that I can have it ready for new players or players who come. Most of my players are actually really experienced tabletop gamers, so they'll come with their own dice. But if I ever do bring someone new to the table, they'll have stuff to get themselves playing. She also had all of the bestiaries. She had every single book, extra copies of the core rulebook so that people could hand them out. And, first off, I know that this is a big material cost, and she even had help getting this stuff. Like, we contributed to a fund so that she could buy the bestiaries or the bestiary pond boxes, the models, the maps. So it was all of us coming together to support having this game master who had everything that they needed and storing it graciously at her place. I've bought all of my stuff on my own, which was probably way more money than I should spend, but now I have really everything I need to be able to run a game. I have plenty of books where my players, if they ever came to my future house, would be able to check out like a library. And I think that there's less expensive ways that you can do it. I mean, first off, the normal pond box, the first bestiary, will get you most of the way there. Paizo also has campaign-specific pond sets where, if you're going to be running Age of Ashes, This is a whole 6-book campaign that is probably going to take you like 2 years. So if you just got the pawn set for Age of Ashes, like, you're going to be good for most of your game. So there's ways that you can have these things that aren't as expensive as like buying every single thing, just enough so that you can get by. So that's one thing that I've tried to emulate from Liz, is having everything that I need to be the game master. My second big inspiration for game mastering comes from Spencer Crittenden. He's the game master for Harmon Quest, which is a hilarious show that is incidentally played with very, very broken and modified rules of Pathfinder First Edition. But it's a great show. If you have a way to watch it, definitely recommend it. But part of what Spencer did as a game master was at the start of the session and at the end, he always gave a recap. And like, you know, part of this is obviously the need for having it be a show. It's, you know, the same thing as having a recap for a series spanning show where you don't always remember like everything that happened in past episodes. So he always starts off with last time on Harmon Quest. And that's a way for you as a game master to remind players about what their goals are for this session that you're playing right now. If you were in the middle of a battle, or maybe the last session, all you did was fight, like, you know, then it's just like, you fought a giant scorpion. That was everything. But if this is something where they need a little nudge in the right direction so that they know that, oh, right, we're trying to find a letter in this house, that's a good time for you to bring up, like, last time the adventurers went into the haunted mansion trying to find a deed left by Lord blah blah blah. It's also a really good way to get everyone energized and back into the mood, because, you know, you probably started off your session, you know, just having table talk. You're all friends, hopefully getting to catch up with everybody about what's been going on with their week. So this little introduction is a good way to kind of get everyone into that space of gameplay, rather than just being like, okay, well, now we're going to start you roll initiative. But also at the end, he always ended with a kind of cliffhanger thing of like, will they find what they were looking for? And will they survive this latest encounter? Find out next time on Harmon Quest. And I try to do the same thing. It's a good way to much more naturally end the session than just saying, all right, well, that's all the time we have. Kind of ends on a cliffhanger. It leaves the players with like, oh man, time's up. Oh, I wish that we could just keep on playing, but now I have to wait a week. Oh man. And one of my players hilariously has gotten to doing the end of the Dragon Ball Z going, so it's a little tradition that we've kept going, and I find it to be a very satisfying way to end a session. My next game master inspiration comes from, you guessed it, Matt Mercer. Matt is the most famous game master, or dungeon master in his case, to ever exist. Critical Role is a phenomenon. Getting a show on Amazon based off of a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, which incidentally started off as a Pathfinder campaign, but has also spawned what is known as the Matt Mercer Effect. If you've never heard of this, it's a kind of rumor that players will come to Dungeons & Dragons or a tabletop game after having watched Critical Role and then have this expectation for a grandiose story, tons and tons of character voices, and leave disappointed because you are not Matt Mercer and you don't have the ability to run a game like Matt Mercer. Personally, I've never encountered this, and largely because I'm not sure the Matt Mercer effect really happens or is all that prolific, but it's something maybe, I guess, to be aware of. But there are two things that Matt Mercer does that I think almost any GM should be able to emulate. The first being the tagline of the show, How do you want to do this? I have not actually really watched Critical Role from start to end. I do not have time to watch 3-hour episodes of 100 episodes of a stream show. And if you can, good for you. It sounds like it's amazing if you can get into it. I just can't. But I have watched clips of when he pulls out, how do you want to do this? And in effect, it's the kill cam of a battle. He pulls it out for really tough battles or for when someone does an insta-kill with like a nat 20. And the question, how do you want to do this, is a chance for the players to give their own description of what happens. And it goes way beyond the base attack of what they're doing. So like if they're doing a sneak attack, typically if you're thinking in terms of like computer game graphics, it would just be someone like going stab, end stab, and then that's it. But this is a chance when you ask them, how do you want to do this, for them to say, yeah, I sneak up behind him, I grab his hair, and I say, not today, and then I slit his throat, and you know, it really gets the players like energized and feeling like they just did something really cool, even though mechanically they didn't do anything different from any other move that they did during that combat. And you know, maybe some players, and I've had this happen, where you do this and they're like, oh, I trip him and then I stab him in the chest. Like, okay, that's not very, like, wordsmithy, and that's fine. Not everyone knows how to use words well. I certainly struggle with them. But you, as a game master, can then take what they said and polish it up. Say, he kicks out the guard's legs, and the guard looks up one last time with his last breath of life as you plunge your dagger in and end his life for good. So it's just a way to make the players feel that much cooler about what they did, and I think that it's something that any GM can add to their game, giving the players a chance to direct their own action instead of always the GM coming up with how something happens. The other thing I think GMs can try to emulate, and something that I try to emulate, is voices. Now, Matt Mercer is, by profession, a voice actor, and so it's unreasonable to say that you can reach the same level of character voice depth and creativity that he's able to do just off the cuff. That said, character voices are actually pretty simple when you stop thinking about them in terms of accents. There is an author for the book series that was a great inspiration, and now, because of things that the author has done, we're not supposed to really prop it up all that much, but the Harry Potter series is a fantastic book series, and you can separate the author from the artist and still recognize that Harry Potter was a good book and helped a lot of people, regardless that J.K. Rowling has now turned into a giant piece of shit. And I grew up listening to the audiobooks because, as I mentioned in the first episode, I hate reading. I like to listen. I listen to audiobooks all the time and podcasts. And Jim Dale is one of the two main voice actors who read the Harry Potter series, the other one being Stephen Fry. And, you know, depending on who you listen to, some people prefer Stephen, some people prefer Jim. I am in Camp Jim, partially because he brought so much unique voice work to the Harry Potter series. In fact, he won an award for coming up with an incredible amount of unique voices. Now, some of this is definitely accent work. He played with a lot of different Englandy accent, Scottish, Irish, etc. But a lot of what he did was just simple pitch changes, which I think that everyone is capable of doing. Like, just listen to this clip right here.
Harry looked up and saw Hermione Granger standing at the top of the white flight of steps to Gringotts. She ran down to meet them, her bushy brown hair flying behind her. What happened to your glasses? Hello, Hagrid. Ooh, it's wonderful to see you two again. Are you coming into Gringotts, Harry?
As soon as I've found the Weasleys, said Harry.
You won't have long to wait,
Hagrid said with a grin. Harry and Hermione looked around. sprinting up the crowded street were Ron, Fred, George, Percy, and Mr. Weasley.
"Harry," Mr. Weasley panted, "we hoped you'd only gone one grade too far."
So there were four distinct characters there: Hermione, Harry, Hagrid, and Mr. Weasley. And hopefully you picked on those differences in character as well pretty easily. In all of those cases, he didn't have to do a dramatic amount of change to his own voice to create a new character. I mean, Hagrid's an exception because he didn't really
ragged and has a Scottish accent, and that's Hagrid.
Like, Hermione is just very airy. Harry is just kind of a little pitch change. And Mr. Weasley kind of has a way of talking that makes him very distinct. So you don't have to run yourself ragged trying to create unique character voices. It can be everything from a simple little pitch change to just a way of talking that can help create a very distinct, non-playable character in your game. And in none of those examples do you have to go into accent territory of using a stereotypical and derogatory accent, trying to make them seem different than you are. A big part of making a character voice doesn't even have to be with how they sound, but the intent behind how they talk. If you listen to the Harry Potter series by Jim Dale, part of how he characterizes Hermione is this wicked smart girl who has to hang out with these dumbasses who get all of the credit and is just kind of like done with it, but also likes them and so keeps on hanging out with them. Ron is kind of a dumbass in his own right, and is much more blue collar in how he talks, how he presents himself. Whereas Harry is, you know, kind of the leadership hero, and for the most part is probably the closest voice to Jim Dale's actual voice in terms of how he voices him throughout the entire series. So putting a kind of character quality behind the voice can help change how you talk, even if you're just using your own regular voice. You could be playing a mayor who just has no time for doing anything, and everything is going crazy, and everything's on fire. They have no time to be able to talk to this adventuring party. They could be totally aloof and doesn't really care about stuff and doesn't have a lot to offer. And in neither of those examples did I have to even change anything about my voice. It was just how I changed the personification of the character. So in the vein of role playing, if you can put yourself into this character's shoes, try to find a reason for why they are part of this story, why they are doing the things that they're doing, and then apply that to the character, you can come up with a distinct character voice for your players. Another one of my GM inspirations is Griffin McElroy, who does the Adventure Zone podcast and is also one of the three brothers in My Brother and Me, which is an incredibly hilarious podcast if you ever get to listen to it. They also made a book about podcasting, which is how I got a lot of the tips to make this podcast. So if you're thinking of doing your own, check out that book as well. Now, the Adventure Zone is largely a comedy podcast for their TTRPGs that they run. But the thing about Griffin that I found that makes him such an interesting GM is that he uses arcs very, very effectively in the entire scope and story of whichever campaign he's running. The most famous one is the first campaign that they ran called Balance. And in each arc, the characters go through very distinct areas and face very distinct challenges when they're doing whatever they're doing. They're trying to find these really destructive artifacts, and each one is in its own little area and somehow causing something to happen. They go all the way from Wild West adventures to space adventure to dimensional adventures to Mad Max road racing, and each one of those is an arc that is kind of centered around this artifact that they're looking for. The arc starts when they begin looking for a artifact and ends when they found it and bring it back to their base on the moon. And no dogs are allowed on the moon. These arcs run 5 to 6 episodes in length and tell very distinct, contained stories within them. My favorite being Wonderland, which was an arc where they went into this area of perpetual pain, run very much like a game show in the most horrific way. And yes, it stayed a comedy podcast throughout that entire thing. Not only did the arc help bring them into a very distinct setting, it also made them have to deal with a very distinct challenge. In Wonderland's case, there was no healing in Wonderland, meaning that every bit of damage that they took was permanent. They had a very real chance of dying and not being able to use any healing spells or potions to recover after a big fight. So it was very, very intense. And on top of that, you had these really sycophantic game show parts where the people who were in control of Wonderland made them do this Wheel of Pain thing. And depending on what they landed on, they could either take that punishment or put it onto someone else, and did this whole, you know, prisoner's dilemma kind of thing. Because you're running them in an arc, you as a game master only have to have a certain number of NPCs, and very rarely do NPCs from one arc turn into NPCs in another. Now, we did have some longer form NPCs being the people in the Bureau of Balance, which was the headquarters for the adventuring party, and those ones you would return to, but largely when the characters were involved in an arc, they were just interacting with characters in that arc. So in the case of Wonderland, they had some fights, but really the only NPCs that they interacted with were the two big bads who were in control of Wonderland. Now, if you're running pre-written adventures, you don't have a whole lot of control over that because you're using the NPCs and the setting and the adventure that are already provided to you by the writers of the Pathfinder module. But if you're coming up with your own campaign, having these arcs can be a good way to add sort of a chapter-ness to your campaign. Ending an arc didn't finish the story, it finished a part of the story, and then they were able to move on to the next thing. It was a very natural way for Griffin's players, being his two brothers and dad, to be able to interact with a wide variety of characters and a wide variety of scenarios without also having to manage hundreds of NPCs at the same time if you were to be doing this campaign in the exact same location. If you take the players to a very distinct location where they have a very definite goal that they have to accomplish, whether that's finding another artifact in their own right, or maybe deposing an authoritarian regime leader, it can be part of the larger campaign while also serving as a sort of side mission. So each arc moved towards the end goal, sort of like how the Marvel movies did it leading up to Endgame, where each movie is its own distinct movie in its own right, but you are leading up to the big climax with Thanos and the Infinity Stone gauntlets that were Endgame and Infinity War. Each arc had something to do with that finale. In this case, spoilers, each of the artifacts was something that they themselves, in a past life that they made themselves forget, was contained the power of being able to stop this tremendous force. And being very vague and very unspecific about it, but each time that they uncovered a bit of the artifact, they uncovered a little bit more about the end goal of the entire campaign. So the arcs stayed relevant, but they didn't take characters away from the overarching goal of the entire campaign. So not only did they have the satisfaction of finishing off particular arcs, but each arc led to a bigger and bigger mystery, and the big climax was when all of the pieces came together, and then that's when you got to the end game portion of it, where you're now fighting the big bad using tools that you gathered throughout these arcs and putting all of the pieces together into a very satisfying conclusion. And the beauty of it is you don't even have to have that conclusion in mind when you start. Griffin didn't when you listen to his podcast ideas. He was just doing the arcs and then finding ways to connect the dots. So you don't even have to have this like pre-written, because we all know that characters will take you off any beaten path that you set up for them. But in running each arc, it gave him more and more ideas about how he wanted the campaign to end. Then he was able to start inputting the cookie crumbs that were leading up to the end. So if I were making my own campaign, finally stopping the training wheels of Adventure Paths, even though all of the Adventure Paths Paizo has made have been great, that is probably how I would choose to run my own campaign. Having arcs where there are self-contained adventures that all lead up to a big, dramatic conclusion. Alright, so before I end, time to do a little sponsorship work. So some of you might not know this, but I have beautiful hair. It is a lush strawberry blonde color, which in combination with my blue eyes and O negative blood make me statistically one of the rarest people on earth. However, I hate my hair. I have always hated my hair, and I've always done what I could to shave it down as far as it can go. And for the longest time, I have used a razor that I got from Costco. It did pretty well, but started to get out of alignment. It was harder to find replacement blades, so I had to make a change. Now, this is true. I had about 5 different kinds of shavers that I tried on Amazon, and each and every time I returned them, either because they felt cheap, they couldn't do the job, or they just broke down doing the most basic functions. So sure, I got free returns, free shipping, but what did that end up costing? It was a lot of time to take my stuff back to the UPS store to be returned. It took time to basically use a bad product and time reading reviews trying to find one that actually worked. So Manscaped's sponsorship opportunity came at actually the exact perfect time, and let me tell you that this shaver does what it's supposed to do. That's the highest compliment that you can probably give any product, is that it does what it's supposed to do. It shaved my head. It shaved it down to where I wanted it to go. If you have hairy parts on other parts of your body, it'll do the exact same thing. And most products will, in some way, do what they're supposed to do. The real question is, will they do it well? Will they do it for a long time? And is it worth your money? And my honest opinion, and I am contractually obligated to give it, is that yes, this is. The grooming razor that they sent to me, called the Lawnmower 4.0, performed its job admirably. And one of the things that I really liked about it that I didn't get from any of those Amazon products was that it had that new phone or new computer feel. Like, it just felt like a good, solid thing. It felt like quality. It didn't feel like cheap plastic. Felt like I could drop it and it would be fine. I even used it in the shower and it works perfectly. Same for the Weed Whacker, which is a nose and ear hair trimmer, which I have been getting more and more as I get progressively older, as we all do in this mortal coil. And so now you're wondering about price. Well, if you go to manscaped.com and you get a little intimidated by the price tag, don't worry, I got you. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code RULELORD at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com, and use the code RULELORD, just like it's spelled on the podcast. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. And my final big GM inspiration comes from Brennan Lee Mulligan, who is the host of Dimension 20. Dimension 20 is part of Dropout, which itself is a part of College Humor, and these campaigns are also very funny. They involve guests like Matt Mercer was a guest one time, guests from the College Humor cast and outside places too. Really funny, really well produced. And the real big takeaway from Brennan is the importance of improv. The ability to come up with quick solutions and not get too bogged down in the rules.
Yeah, but isn't this show called Rise of the Rule Lords?
Yes, but the tagline is don't let the rules rule you, and Brennan does not. If you're watching the show, you'll see that he just pulls DCs out of thin air. Now, granted, he's running Dungeons & Dragons, which use much smaller numbers than Pathfinder does. However, he just gets a general idea of how difficult something would be, and then comes up with a number, and that's what players have to roll against. Now, part of the beauty of Pathfinder is that Pathfinder has rules for everything. There's set DCs already made for different kinds of blocks, for climbs, for different kinds of challenges. So GM doesn't have to come up with their own DCs in Pathfinder. But what I've seen from Brennan is that it can help keep the pacing going if you don't use those rules. If a character wants to jump from one moving vehicle to another moving vehicle, he doesn't take out the Dungeon Master Guide and look up the distance rules. He's like, okay, that'll be DC 17. Instant decision. Instantly, the player gets to keep on with their dice roll, and ultimately, the dice will determine what happens. With the way Pathfinder is built, we don't quite have that level of freedom of choice. If you're playing with 5th level characters and you say DC 10, that is ridiculously easy. Rather, I keep table 10-5 up for every single game that I play, and that's the DCs by level table. It tells me what the level-based DC is for whichever level the character's playing at, in which case in my Ruby Phoenix tournament, they're all playing at 12th level right now, which has a DC of 30. Now, in the same vein as Brennan, now I can use that DC 30 to come up with numbers much quicker, and I don't need to try to look up general rules for, like, climbing a wall. The DC by level means that this is a DC that players should be able to meet pretty consistently. The drawback to this, rather than looking up a specific rule, is that it does have the potential to take away the feeling of growing power that is inherent with playing Pathfinder. Because of the increase in proficiency and that we have much higher modifier numbers at higher levels, means that things that would be pretty hard for low-level characters should be really, really easy for higher levelers. So if you're playing at level 15 and someone says that they want to climb a wall, well, maybe in that case it is worth looking up what the climb wall DC is for whatever type of building structure they're trying to climb, rather than have a DC of 34, which is the level by DC for level 15. However, if it's a circumstance that is totally unprecedented, the surprises that players are very likely to pull on you, this table is a great way to just have a general idea of where the DC should be, and then you can add 2 to make it a little bit harder, or add 5 to make it a lot harder, and same for reversing it to make it easy. If we're playing at level 12, if I have a DC of 28, that's going to be a little bit easier, and if I do a DC of 32, that's going to be a little bit harder. But because I know that DC is 30, it gives me the baseline for coming up with really quick decisions about what a DC for whatever the player is coming up with would be. So those are things that I've taken away from GMs and tried to do in my games too. The biggest overall thing that was common amongst all of these GMs, though, was a pretty firm grasp of not just the rules, but how to apply them, and putting story above rules lawyering. Rules are important. The randomness of dice rolls is part of what makes storytelling in one of these TTRPG games different than just a bunch of people standing around in a table sharing a story. The chances of failure bring about conflict and thus challenges that people have to overcome and make it much more satisfying than always saying, "I win because of nothing. I just win." But they all knew when to set aside strict adherence to the rules to just let a story play out, to overall make it so that it's a fun game for players, and because many of the people that I listed are entertainers, making it entertaining for the audience. And very often, those two things intertwine. The rules of a role made probably one of the most cinematic scenes in the Adventure Zone's history, where, again, and this is in the Wonderland campaign, someone's soul was being sucked into this dimension, and someone did dimension step, and then we're able to see them, and we're grasping out, and then the third character cast Mage Hand so that they could grab the astral projection, and then all three of them got brought back to the material plane. Now, that scene could have been turned into complete garbage if Griffin had prioritized, let's check the rules to make sure you can do that. Instead, he just let it play out. He still did have some roles, so there was still a chance of failure for the players. But the fact that he let it happen, that he didn't put the rules over the story of the players' fun, made it this incredibly visceral scene that when you listen to it, just sticks with you. And in the same way, if you bring that to your campaign, you can come up with some of the most memorable scenes ever. One that will always stick with me is one that I did with Liz with one of my first characters. They were definitely an edgelord before I knew what an edgelord was. But my character, who was a fetchling called Araby, was blinded. I was an archer, so that made it really hard for me to hit anything. But she let me do a series of skill checks where I was hanging upside down from a trap door, listening to advice from other players who were pointing out stuff. There were no rules for doing this, but Araby, blinded, hanging upside down, did 3 shots into the bad guy, killing them. It was one of the most awesome moments. And Liz didn't let it get bogged down by rules at all. She had DCs, she still had me roll, and I was able to succeed and had this really memorable moment that sticks with me to this day. So that's why the tagline for this show is "Don't let the rules rule you." They're important to know, they're important to bring to a table, but really the things that are going to make your game great are the things that you, as a GM, and your GMing philosophy do to influence how the game runs at your table. If you're strict, if you don't let players do the things that they want to do, they're going to have a bad time and they're going to quit your game. But if you can bring these little extra things to make it a more memorable experience for your players, to make your game better, you're going to end up being an awesome GM. And something that Liz brought up when I asked if I could talk about her was that she doesn't feel like she is a great GM. And that's probably something that a lot of other GMs feel. It's called imposter syndrome. You feel like a fraud. You don't recognize that you're doing good work. But I'm here to tell you, even if you don't do any of these things, even if you keep on running your game exactly how you are, if you are a GM, you are doing great. You are telling a story, you are bringing people together to have a shared experience. That is not easy, and it's hard to get out of that feeling of imposter syndrome. You can't just tell yourself, "I'm good enough." I mean, you should tell yourself that you're good enough, but it's hard to really believe it. Often, this does need to come from outside sources, so if you're a player listening to this, make sure to let your GM know that you love them, that you appreciate what they're doing, that you love that they're running this game for you, that you love what they have brought to your game. But for you GMs, know that just in the simple step of deciding to be a game master means that you are already doing the incredible. You don't have to do a single character voice. You do not have to plan a world-spanning campaign. You don't have to do anything extra before or after your game. The fact that you are just running this game means that you are doing a lot, and you should be proud of yourself. The only evidence that you really need that you're doing a good job is that players come to the next session. If they didn't want to play in your game, if they thought that you were doing a bad job, they wouldn't show up. They would just stop coming, might even ghost you, might even tell you off about how you're doing a bad job. But if you're running this game and people show up for the next session, if they show up ready to play at the next session, you are doing a good job. You are a good GM. So if you want to bring any of the lessons that I've learned from other GMs to your table, that's awesome. If you have any of your own ideas for how you've made your game better, let me know at RuleLord2E on Twitter, and go on to RuleLord2E.com for more ways to listen. And remember, be sure to give me one of those community use policy agreements so I can play it at the start of an episode. Go to RuleLord2E.com to learn how you can do that. But until next session, you awesome and incredible player or GM, don't let the rules rule you.